The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
All right, are you ready? We're going to get started. Hope you enjoyed your lunch and that you are ready for the afternoon session. So I have the pleasure of moderating this session, which has really esteemed panelists and speakers on it. And we're going to talk about something that I think is near and dear to a lot of our hearts here, which is really looking at looking kind of the opportunities that we have for fundraising and organizational development, even though the times that we are in right now are quite challenging. Earlier this morning, I don't know if any of you went to it, but there was a session this morning that really focused on today's economic climate, and we explored the impact of that on education and other communities in the U.S. And this conversation here this afternoon is going to start from a similar premise, but it focuses specifically on the nonprofit sector. So, Neil, if you don't mind, Neil, just raising your hand. Neil is my note taker and time person, so you all know. And Neil, if you don't mind filling up one more chair for Oman here, we'll get started. So, you can see we have a full panel and we have a lot to discuss, so I'm going to get started. So, I'm going to quickly paint a picture of some of the ways in which the nonprofit sector is dealing with today's challenging times. For service providers, the need for safety net services has increased tremendously because of the slow economy, the lack of housing availability, and the rising unemployment rate. And I think all of you know that very well. In fact, many of the organizations that are present at the summit have told us that they've seen significant increased calls to their hotline. Some of the materials that Vanya is passing out are from the Fund for Philanthropy that really talk about this increase in the need for safety net services. But at the same time, nonprofit organizations are experiencing the impact of organized philanthropy cutback when it comes to funding. So we're going to talk a little bit about what that means. And then there's also the case of individual donor giving. Nonprofits depend heavily on charitable donations, which tends to be on the decline in some circumstances. So while this paints a little bit of a bleak picture, our panelists today are really going to talk about the light at the end of the tunnel. We'll hear from individuals who are in organized philanthropy, as well as development staff and organizational development experts, about how we can actually find opportunity in today's challenging times. So I'm going to start off by introducing our panelists very briefly and then asking them a series of questions, and then we'll throw it open to all of you for Q&A. So to my left here is Dimple Adichandani. Dimple is with the Proteus Fund. She joined the Proteus Fund in October 2008. And she's the National Security Human Rights Program Officer there. Next is Sunil Oman. Sunil is the Development Director at South Asian Youth Action, or SAYA, which was founded in 1996. And it's the first and only organization of its kind in the U.S. working to develop the skills, talent, and leadership potential of South Asian youth in New York City. Next is Archana Sagal. Archana is the Post 9/11 Civic Engagement Fund Director and Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in philanthropy, which has its main office in San Francisco. We've also got Hilary Binder-Avile. Hilary is the Senior Specialist and Director of Immigrant and Refugee Programs at Mosaica, which is an organization here in the DC area. And actually, she's also been working with Hilary on our strategic planning process, and she's been very helpful to us. And finally, we have Uma Rao. Uma works at Chaya, which is a community-based nonprofit organization in Seattle that serves South Asian women in times of crisis and need. So I know we've got a lot of folks on our panel, but you can already publicly see that we have Sunil and Uma, who are both doing development work at MCSO organizations. We've got Hilary, who's doing a lot of organizational development and counseling for organizations who might be wondering, how do we structure ourselves now? What do we think about as we move through the economic crisis and challenging times that we have? And we've also got Archana and Dimple, who are working in more of the organized philanthropy space, either with foundations or they direct funds, and so they have a real sense of what's happening in organized philanthropy. So I want to go ahead and get us started then by getting a perspective from a few of you. So Archana, I'm going to start with you and ask you to tell us a little bit about what is the impact of today's economic climate on organized philanthropy. And I think you know that a lot of the folks sitting here are working at organizations in the South Asian community that are quite small. So tell
to my colleagues in the Land Committee about the great work that Philip has been doing and co-creating and pushing forward, and really being a model of how a national nonprofit can work very closely with local and regional nonprofits. And the second thing is to really acknowledge the wealth of knowledge that's in this room. So I'm sure that any one of you all can be on this panel because you guys are in it day after day after day. So thank you so much. I really want to encourage you to not just ask questions, but to share your experiences as well. So let's go back into this question. As Deepa mentioned, I run a philanthropic fund focused not only on grant making, but around capacity building to Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, and South Asian communities. And as a corollary of the fund, we also help to leverage additional resources for community members. What's really exciting about the recession is that there was starting to gain a ton of traction, actually, from the acknowledgement of the needs and opportunities in working with the South Asian community. Also, being actually quite successful in garnering additional resources for the South Asian
and now to the would you speak up on those slides?
Oh, sorry.
Can you use a microphone if you have one?
I will speak louder. So unfortunately, like I was saying, is that there's a little small problem called the mortgage lending crisis. And with the lending crisis, and I'm sorry to be such a Debbie Downer, but I will promise to be a little bit more uplifting and talk about opportunities at the end. But really, truly, we actually saw a very kind of depressing state for the last 3 or 4 months around mainstream organized philanthropy giving directly to Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, and South Asian communities organizations. There has been a few highlights, including the great work that NPHL is running through the National Security and Human Rights Collaborative, but all in all, it's pretty depressing. So two things. One is a friend of mine at the Lawrence Community Civil Rights Lunch, Latifa Simon, said, "The well is always dry for our communities." And marginalized communities, low-income communities have always been in the position of fighting to be at the table. And so I think that this is no different whether we're in a recession or at a recession. The problem is that when you're in a recession, the well is not just dry, but you're so thirsty. And you're just like looking for anything, water, anything, drops of water. And so for me, I'm hoping to reframe our work and our work with our community partners in 2009 and maybe even 2010, and hopefully not until 2011, around cultivation. So in terms of laying the groundwork and kind of greasing the wheels to build those relationships that you need to build with organized philanthropy so that when the spigots turn on again, that there'll be the relationships to move forward in terms of partnering with other funders, philanthropic institutions, to bring resources to the table.
Okay. Thank you so much, Arjuna. And we're glad that there are these lights at the end of the tunnel. But, Nipal, can you add a little bit to that and talk specifically about the cultivation model that Arjuna talked about? Is that what organizations should be thinking about right now, cultivating partnerships and relationships with funders?
Maybe I'll start by just adding a little bit to what Arjuna said. And for this one, I should start by thanking all of you. For your leadership. Just to sort of give you a sense of what's happening in philanthropy, many institutional funders, the money that they sort of give out to their grants is money that really comes from their endowments. And so just to kind of plug pieces of it together, what's happened with the mortgage crisis and sort of the collapse of the stock market is that the actual assets that these foundations have dramatically decreased. Okay, so it's not just a little bit, but most foundations are talking about having a decline somewhere in the range of 25% to 30% in terms of their assets. And so the steps that they've been taking, there's been a range, but the steps that people have been taking include things like cutting back on their grant making, eliminating grant making altogether for this year. And both Archana and I, we run funds, but we both also have to raise money to bring to our funds. And so I think we've probably both been hearing this from potential donors. So I just wanted to sort of give that kind of perspective that, grant making is down by around 20% to 25% for many of the larger donors. And one thing that I've sort of seen is that there's one of the practices has been this decision not to add new grantees. And that's something that I think our communities have to think about, because we, I think as a community, we have kind of emerging organizations. So I think what Archer was really important in terms of the timing of this economic crisis, it came right at a time when our community was starting to build up capacity. We're starting to see organizations emerge on the local level, on the national level. And right at that moment comes this crisis. And but from the perspective of program officers, what you hear them talking about is, well, I have this budget cut that I have to do, and I need to protect the organizations that I've cultivated in the last decade. So I've built up all these groups, and I need to think about their needs first before adding new organizations to that list. So I think we'll have time to talk about this later. One of the things I would say that you should think about is, as you're reaching out to foundations, I think the cultivation piece is key. Don't think just about, you know, how am I going to get money for this year, but like Archana said, sort of think more long-term. Think about building relationships now that you can use next year and the year after. And think about the challenge that's posed by the kind of what I call like the no new organization framework, right? So think about how you can move somebody from that position and how you can convince them that it's not about new versus old, but it's about what's needed at this moment. How is your organization relevant? How are you doing what needs to be done? So that it's not a question of, well, but I support this group for 5 years, so I can't back away from now. And then I have more stories.
Yeah, we'll definitely get to tips and then obviously to specific questions, any scenarios from the audience as well. So we heard a little bit about the impact of we heard a little bit about where organized philanthropy is, about this 25-30% decline, about not necessarily moving into new organizational funding. So that's from the philanthropic side. Now I want to turn to Sunil and Uma to talk a little bit about what you're seeing as development directors at your organization from the nonprofit side. And in addition to talking about impact, could you also talk a little bit about what are some steps that you all are taking at your organization to do this prospective thinking ahead? So Sunil, I'll start with you.
Sure. I think that the impact on the nonprofit industry is pretty much known to all of us. So I won't go into it in detail. But for those of you who may not be in the throes of the industry, I mean, there have been a series of layoffs and organizations rethinking their hiring strategies, things like that. But the impact on nonprofits that I thought would be helpful to share is the fact that there's been a wake-up call, and the fact that I think that there are two main takeaways that I have from this. One is the real need, and Dibble had addressed this, and I would concur, the real need to demonstrate effectiveness of our nonprofits and to demonstrate that our work is relevant. And how do you do that? I think that we need, as an industry, especially in the South Asian community, more language, more research, and I'll talk about that later, into the effectiveness of our work, making that case known. And the second point is the need to focus on marketing during this time. It's not enough that we do good work. I think that we all do good work, right? But it's how we could spread the word about that work in the most effective ways. So I think that if anything, these times are more of an opportunity to spread the word, because there are media outlets that are seizing stories about how certain communities are flailing. For instance, SIA was part of a piece on local Fox 5 as well as UPN television in New York, as part of the story on Asian American poverty in New York City, as part of a new study. So we had SIA's executive director featured, as well as some of our youth. And we've gotten a lot of attention as a result of that, and we promoted it to our listserv. So we're really trying to advertise and promote the fact that we are doing good work out there. So those are the two main takeaways that, you know, I would say would be helpful for all nonprofits to think about at this time.
Great. Thank you for giving us those really concrete suggestions. And I'd like to turn it over to you to tell us a little bit about, you know, at Chaya, how you all are reacting to the climate and some tips that you might have as well for nonprofits in the same situation.
Sure. Sure. The first thing I wanted to acknowledge was that it is a huge challenge. So I know that we had talked on our panel about how we actually wanted to really speak positively and that there are opportunities, and there certainly are, and we definitely want to share those and learn from you all. And just if you're sitting there thinking, but this is really hard, it is really hard, and I think so too, and I think we all think so. So, and I think one of the challenges that I'm coming across is that we're all pretty clueless about it, and it's changing day to day, it seems like. So that's making it even harder for us to plan and to really think ahead. So I just wanted to put that out there and say, this is hard. Yes, it is, you know, and so, and with that, here are some ideas, or here are some things, here's how Chai is approaching it, and maybe you have ideas too. So, we're a human services organization, or at least a big part of what we do is human services, and looking at my sister up and over there because she is too. And so what we're finding, a lot of our human services money come from government, right? And government is really at the state level and the county level and at the city level really cutting a lot of their human services funding. In Washington State, we're looking at almost an entire cut. So it's actually very, very dry for that. But federal monies are coming out. I mean, I guess Obama can just print new money and call it the economic stimulus and put it out there. And it's actually really good. And it's also highly competitive. You know, a lot of us are applying for these federal monies, but that shouldn't stop you. So please do. In terms of individual donors, and I think that Sunil will probably talk about this more too, and we both can talk about it, that actually our community, the South Asian community, we are philanthropists naturally, and I definitely want to talk more about that. Okay, so I'll wait on that. But a lot of, like Sunil was saying, we're focusing also on individuals. And again, because individuals are really clueless about what's happening, it's also a challenge there, but I definitely want to share ideas when we get to that about how I'm working with South Asian donors. And then, finally, in terms of planning, which Deepa was asking about, so at Chaya, what we've done is we have two different budget scenarios right now. And what we're doing is every quarter, so just now, you know, the first quarter ended in March, we took a look at where our income projections are now after 3 months. And it actually is really drastically different from where it was in December, what we thought we could make, right? And so it's actually really different now, so we have to change our budget. We're not going to do that yet until June in the middle of the year because, again, it could change. But I highly encourage you all, as you're planning with your organizations, to actually look at it with that minutia, like look at it really often, not every week because that's just going to freak you out, but every month or every 3 months for sure. Have your board really look at that with you and be really diligent about it. And so we project incomes over again every quarter, and then we're going to review in June. It also, I think the opportunity that's happening right now is that we, and I think South Asian organizations, we have this need and desire to really do a lot. And I think SALT put out a report last year just saying, like, actually we do a lot with very little resources. And that is something that's, you know, a blessing and a curse. And I think this is the opportunity for us to actually really focus. What is our mission? What do we say we do? And the fact is that since we're the only South Asian organizations in our areas, maybe even in our state, as is the case with Chai in terms of what we do, we're the only ones that serve South Asians in our state, we actually get a lot of different needs and a lot of different women's issues, people wanting us as a resource for reproductive justice, as a resource for all kinds of things, and we have to actually stop now and say, we can't do that. We have to do this. This is where our funding is right now. And we don't have the room to actually do a lot more with a little. And so that's one of the opportunities that's coming right now is for us to really focus, and maybe I'll speak more to that as an organizational planner. But I just wanted to put that out there, too. So really to buckle down, be strategic, think about what you're doing, and know in advance, if you have to cut programs, which ones are you going to cut? So having that as part of your planning, what you're thinking about, what are you willing to cut? Not that you'd be happy to do any of that, but what are you willing to cut? To know that in advance. And are your community's needs assessed? Like, do you know what your community is saying that they need from you? And there is research out there, and, you know, Chaya did a needs assessment with our community last year, so we have some of that information, which is helping us to plan as well.
The information about the two budget scenarios is really useful. I know I can say that from our organizational standpoint too, and maybe for many of the folks in this room. And I like that think about the opportunity to use this opportunity to define ourselves, you know, in terms of who we are as an organization. I want to bring Hillary into the conversation too, because I think that there's a really good segue here. Just to talk a little bit, Hillary, about the concrete tips when it comes to to, you know, doing risk assessment, when it comes to reviewing budgets, what do you recommend when you're talking to organizations who are worried about their bottom line, who are worried about laying off staff or such programs?
I think a lot of it is sort of echoes what folks have said here, and that there's no one right answer. And I think a lot of our role and my role as a consultant working with community-based organizations has been helping people sort of just ask as many different questions as you can and look at what's happening from sort of as many different angles as you can. So step back, take stock, and don't panic. Because you don't make good decisions when you're operating in a place of kind of, oh my gosh, what do we do? Panic, let's go do this, let's go do this. And, you know, let's cut that. So I think it's really just sort of being able to calmly sit down, get a group of people together, some of your, you know, the kind of most creative folks from your organization, best strategic thinkers from your organization, and really break it down and say, okay, where are we? Asking yourselves all of these questions. Let's look at budget first, and, you know, and some, do we have to cut anything right now? Because maybe we don't. Maybe we're okay for a while, but let's look at, you know, maybe a big, identify the unknowns. If what will we do if this doesn't come through? We think this is going to come through. We're pretty, you know, take every one of your funding sources and kind of assess what's the likelihood that one's going to continue? What's the likelihood this one isn't? And then kind of align those with what's really most important to us. What is it that's core to what we do? What do we have to keep doing? Because it's the greatest needs in our community and it's core to who we are and what we do. And you may also be able to renegotiate with some of your existing funders. I've worked with a couple organizations that have gotten restricted funding for something that they kind of stepped back and said, this really is not the most important thing we want to be doing. And they've gone back to their funder and said, you know, can we move this money? This we really want to focus more on this program. So I think it's not a time to sort of make any assumptions, but a time to, if when in doubt, talk to your funders. When in doubt, you know, ask for help from your colleagues, from your board members, and bring the best kind of thinkers in your organization together to really kind of map it out and do a whole sort of if-then. You know, what do we do when that happens? And then the only other thing I'd like to add, too, I think in addition to everything that's been said here, is use each other. And you know, this is a network. Tap into the networks that you're part of. And I'll just share one quick little anecdote. We've been working with a group of small community-based organizations in a county outside Washington. And it's a capacity-building effort, and they've been coming together over a course of 6 months, and we've been doing training. And we decided to do is we asked, at our last session, we asked each organization to come thinking about five things they have to offer and five things they need. And we literally did sort of a speed dating rotation. And at the end of that, and everybody had, each organization came together for like 10 minutes and discussed. And then we went around the room, and it was amazing what had come out of it. We had an organization that got new space that was cheaper than what they were paying. Another organization that got some donated computers. Another organization that was going to have a group of students come from another, you know, and do a project. Joint training, cross-training, because people are having to cut back on their staff development, and so they're finding out they're doing some of the same training, and they said, well, we'll do it together. And also a plan that to pursue shared back office. So one of the larger organizations said they might be willing to provide the shared fiscal management resources for about four different smaller ones. So that using each other.
Yeah, that's a really great, I'm glad that you brought that example up, because I think it shows that there are ways for us to connect together and leverage each other's resources so that we're not all spending money on sort of the same thing in terms of planning or, you know, opportunities, et cetera. And I want to actually go on something else you said, Hillary, and ask Dimple and Archana this. You said, tell the truth to your funders. And I don't know about some of you, but I always feel a little uncomfortable telling any funder that there's a problem or that, you know, there's a concern or really worried that I don't know, et cetera, et cetera. And because we were taught not to be vulnerable in front of the funding world, right? So do you agree that it's important for you all to hear about what's going on? How do you suggest that we talk to you in that sort of situation? So Dimple, if you can start with that, and Archana, perhaps tap onto that, and then
actually, I should share one thought before the question. I wanted to go back to the point that Hillary and Mava both made about the importance of sort of using the tech focus, and just sort of add from a kind of funder's perspective why that's so important. Whereas a few years ago, maybe in your community there would have been funding for two or three organizations, in this moment there might just be funding for one. And so it's going to really, that funding is most likely going to go to sort of whoever is doing the best work, however that is measured. And so this is a great time for you to think about what do you do best? What is the strongest piece of your program? And that is hopefully your core. And that's why kind of, I think, doing that focus and sort of honing in on, well, this is what we do better than anyone else, and leading with that will sort of create opportunities. So on this question, telling the truth, and how to do it. Yeah, so I think actually one of the things I worry about most in our community in terms of how the economic crisis is playing out for our nonprofits is, we have amazing leaders in our organizations, and I think sometimes there's this, there's a tendency to kind of personalize this crisis and feel like, well, I'm the executive director and it's a personal failure that I haven't raised enough money, or it's a personal failure that I didn't see this coming. And I think that's, for so many reasons, just the worst possible approach. And, from where I sit, we are so aware that this is not about your organization, or about, as a leader, your personal failing. This is a global financial crisis. This is a crisis within philanthropy. And as a result, this is a crisis in our communities. It's nothing to hide. And I think that the groups that are going to do well are groups that are going to reach out and be honest about the struggle and reach out and try to find allies. And those allies are going to be people in this room. It's going to be other community groups. I love what you just shared, Hillary, in terms of how we have all these resources amongst ourselves. And then I think that where you have people within foundations that you have built a relationship with and that you trust, I think the sooner that you can be honest that sort of that there are these challenges coming up, the greater likelihood there is that you're going to get assistance. And I think the way to think about it is when someone is giving you a grant, it's they're investing in you. We give a grant with the hope that your vision and your project is going to succeed. And so if there's something else that's going to interfere with that success, then, if you have a good relationship, and I completely understand that there might be times that you don't, but if you have a good relationship, then see that person or that entity that invested in you as an ally and reach out. And there's all kinds of things that sort of your partners within philanthropy can do. They can share information about your program with other funders. They can, publicize your work. They can hold a funders briefing. They can help you rethink your work. I mean, they can do whatever it is that you need that would be helpful. I think it's worth it to reach out. I know that's not the most conventional perspective, but I think it
helps to hear that, and also to be told it's not a personal failure. Archana, could you touch upon this a little bit? But then I do want to move the conversation into individual donors. So if you could touch upon this and then add that, and Sunil and Emma will get you, and then we're going to move into Q&A.
So on the philanthropic piece, so for me, trust is a ton of art. It depends on how you define it. I mean, not trust. Truth is a term of art,
and it's depending on how you actually define that truth. So first of all, as kind of adding on what Dipal said, the importance of developing and cultivating relationships with your program staff in philanthropy. I cannot tell you how important it is to cultivate that relationship over the long haul. Oftentimes, and I'm not saying any of you do this, but many organizations treat their donors and their foundations as ATM machines or ATMs. You know, and that's fine, but when, you know, when there's hard times and when the well is dry, that's not really so useful. And so I really want to really kind of highlight that piece of it, the ongoing relationship building, so that you can have those deep conversations around what is the truth. So for me, I want to hear it all. I mean, truth be told, I want to hear your struggles. I want to see, hear your good points, your bad points. I want to see it all. But to be totally honest with you, a lot of my colleagues do not because of different reasons, right? And so for me, when you know one foundation, you know one foundation. Because each of us are so different. We have a different, you know, a different kind of worldview on the work. And on the flip side, in terms of truth, so let me give you a little example. So with every single... So we started the Civic Engagement Fund about 3 years ago, and with the first granting cycle, each of the organizations submitted budgets to us, and every single one of those budgets had a balance sheet of zero. Not a balance sheet, but expenditures and income was kind of, it was even out to zero. Okay, you all know, please, when was the last time your budget was actually met, the income and expenditures? Never, never, ever, ever. I'd be shocked if it was to the penny, zero to zero. Or spend the spending. So what is the truth there? I mean, really, truly, program officers, generally speaking, do not want to see in the red. But the real deal is that I do. And so it took me years to develop the relationships with, you know, CFOs, executive directors, to tell them, look, I really want to know how your budget's doing. Please resubmit your grant proposal with an actual budget that really lists how your financial health is doing. But when I told my other colleagues that I was doing that, they were like, we don't want to know. And so, yeah, so it's a little bit, so that's me, but that's not my colleagues in the Bay Area or my colleagues in Chicago. And so everyone is a little bit different, but that goes back to the idea that truth is a term of art. But I really do want to highlight and kind of underscore what Dipal said in terms of we are your best advocates. When you get punched by someone, we are your best advocates. And at the end of the day, they say the biggest joke is, we never want to see you on the news for kind of embezzlement or kind of going down before, you know, before you tell us. And so I've seen that. Really, truly. So it happened when I was at the San Francisco Foundation. In fact, one of the organizations at the San Francisco Foundation, which is a fund, ended up in the news because that CFO was embezzling money. And so, and we heard about it on the news. And we were like, what is going on with you? You need to let us know. Because then, at the end of the day, the biggest problem is we don't want to look like idiots. And that's the real deal. Because at the same time, this is our job. We get paid to be the best advocates for you. And so if you're not giving us the real deal, and if you're not giving us your ups and downs, and I'm really talking about your ups, we want to know about your successes, your achievements. We want to know about your struggles. But in order to really share that authentically, we need to know you and have that trust built between you, your management team, and your organization.
That's great. Thank you. I feel like there will be some questions about that percolating from the audience, too. Let's move on to the last topic we wanted to cover before we open it up for Q&A. We want to have a lot of time for a period of change. So, which is the conversation around individual donor giving. And you said earlier, Emma, that you think that, you know, you believe the foundation's very philanthropic and that there is an opportunity here in terms of making sure that we're seeing foundation philanthropy grow. Others might be seeing that it's harder to get people to join up to be members or to give like the $35 or the $50 a year. So I would like to have you start and then I want to talk a little bit about specific ways in which your nonprofit or generally the advice you can give us in terms of cultivating and identifying individual donors at this time.
Sure. I think that it's important first to quickly define the fact that there's not one South Asian community. I think that we all know that it's heterogeneous and that there are, you know, many different motivations, but for the sake of this presentation, I'll just split the communities into two. One is the immigrant, generally older, the aunties and uncles of our community, and two, the U.S. born or had been enough to have been acculturated by by American culture. They are Eurocentric. If they're in the universe of South Asian organizations, they have already gone through their cultural identity crisis to the point where they have renewed their interest in South Asian. And I'm laying all these out because actually it does speak to the motivations of donors. Because in sales, it's a matter of determining what people want, right? Why do people buy drills? Because they want holes, right? That's exactly what it is. So you have to create, if somebody wants holes, you create the product for it. So in some ways, in fundraising, you also have to do the same specifically for individuals, and I think it'll also apply to other entities as well. So, having worked at SIA, and I'm also on the board of SALT, I've had the opportunity to see fundraising from both a direct services point of view as well as an advocacy point of view. And everyone's different, but these are my main general observations on the South Asian community and their motivations for giving. One is prestige. They either like their name out there, or there's a huge subset of people who make sure that they don't want their names out there at all because it's taboo to talk about money, but they really want to be acknowledged on the sly, in the back room. It's for networking, for social ladder climbing. Let's put it out there. I mean, that's really what a lot of South Asian individual donors are for, are into. And there's a way to work it, to make sure that what these individual donors want and what these organizations can do align. There's also networking from a partner as well. Some of the events that we do at SIA are de facto shoddy.com events, which is a matrimonial website. So it's an opportunity for people to get together. And we capitalize on that. And it's also the feeling of giving back and that makes them feel good, and how do we find ways to make them feel good about their work. So those are just general, which sounds extremely self-absorbed, but at the same time, this is what I've determined the community to be. I mean, we have, those who are purely in it for the good cause, etc., but they fall into the category of they give because they want to feel something good, they want to see a return on investment. So, that's basically, I just wanted to throw that out right out there, right, some observations, and I could go into the tips maybe after Hooman says a few words on this.
Yeah, that'd be great. Should I talk specifically on what you all are doing in China to get to these people that Sunil has described for us?
Absolutely. And I think, I think Sunil's being very real, and it's very true. And, it's also just to add to what Sunil said, South Asians, like I said, are natural philanthropists. Growing up, I'm second generation. I'm in the second category that he was talking about. And I graduated high school and got, $10, $15, $50, $100 from uncles and aunties just because I graduated high school and I was going on in life. And that's really what kind of community we are. We want to invest in our future. We want to invest in young people, in people's success. So just to also capitalize on that. And also we give to honor, right? So will you give this gift in honor of your daughter, in honor of your mother, in honor of your sister, who has experienced domestic violence, who has witnessed it, because most of us have. So to also capitalize on some of these other things, in addition to, we want the name recognition, absolutely. A lot of our community folks want to be out there. And to that, don't forget your events. If those of you who are doing events, like whether they're shadi.com type events, Chaya does an auction, an annual dinner. If you can afford to do it, please do it, because people are going to come to support you. Everybody knows what the status is. They might not spend as much, but you still do it because it's also about fundraising in addition to fundraising. And they want to be recognized publicly. So I brought samples of our auction sponsorship brochure, and I didn't bring a whole lot of them, but I'm happy to pass them along to people just so you get a sense of what they look like or what it is. And you can also send you the template if you want to copy it. But you'll notice, if you go to the back side, our last year's sponsors that we listed, there are a lot of individual names. They're not necessarily corporations. They're not necessarily companies. Because that's who we've ended up turning to actually sponsor these events, and they want their name associated with this event. It's become kind kind of, you know, the South Asian event in our community, and I think that we all have that potential within our organizations because we are one of the few organizations serving our entire communities, which are huge. We actually do, they actually do get recognized where we are. It's not like the United Way or the Red Cross where they get lost in that crowd. They actually get the recognition at our events. So to capitalize on that, and also like the smaller companies that you'll see, they're really South Asian owned businesses, tech businesses or whatever they are. So to have that name recognition and all of that there and to be acknowledged publicly. And then finally, concentrating on the individuals that can give smaller amounts, Obama style, right? Like go for the smaller amounts from larger amounts of people, memberships or investments or whatever it is. You know, I'm trying to launch what I'm just basically a sustained monthly giving campaign so that I actually know I'm getting at least $500 a month. And there are some months that I don't actually know what I'm getting. And so that's my current like initiative that I'm working on project-wise is like I want to know that I'm getting at least a certain amount, and that can be a lot of the younger folks in our community who are actually being more acculturated to giving, to giving back to our community. I mean, I think there's like South Asian studies now in colleges, which it wasn't there when I was going to school. You know, I think we actually have a younger generation that's really invested in our community, so try to tap into that as well.
Right. Yeah. So I know that there are multiple people that want to add on to this, but would it be okay if we actually took a pause here to go to the audience? And I want to collect some questions, but we'll definitely get one when you hear some of these tips and Archnet specifically around individual giving symbols. Okay, so let's actually turn it over to you all. I want to take a few questions, and then we'll see how we can synthesize them with the panel. So responses, questions, etc. A lot of hands up, I want to see. Okay, we'll start with Chadwick here.
Just to two populations of potential donors that I think are of great interest to folks that I'd love to hear more about were one, individual major donors, and then the sphere of foundations that have sort of walled off new grantees. And I know you guys were talking about don't necessarily accept that, think about ways to demonstrate relevance and effectiveness, but if you have any ideas on how to present new grantee relationships to foundations.
Take a couple more. Maybe Nelson, just introduce yourself really quickly.
Yeah, Paul Rosby, I'm with the Council of People's Organization. My question is to the funders, have you emphasized to the groups that you're funding that you would be more inclined to, I guess, support them if they start to collaborate with other groups immediately? Because that's one of the things that I'm finding out other, you know, foundations didn't even talk about. But partnership that we're finding out, partnership is the key. But is that, you know, your goal? Also,
great question.
I'm Kartika, and I'm asking this question on behalf of the Shakti Peer Group, which is a membership-based, kind of semi, right now volunteer-based led group on domestic violence, organizing group, peer education group on domestic violence. So the question is that our work is very unique in terms of DV, that it's not looking at it from a service provision framework, but that's also very different in terms of most funders are used to thinking in such a framework. Oh, so if we were offering services in a way, I feel like we would be more apt to be understood in terms of what we are trying to do. So how do you actually reach out to funders to show them something that's not like is a different angle in the kind of work that they may be used to, but in a different framework? And because we're kind of right now, we're starting from the very ground up, like we don't have barely any funding, so it's all new to us. So anything that you provide information on that.
Una, you said that you looked at your budget in December, and yeah.
Me? Okay.
You said that you looked at your budget in December and then in March.
Yeah.
So did they go up or did they go down?
Okay.
It's getting worse or better?
Yeah. You already answered that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's getting worse.
It's getting worse.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Okay. So there are a couple of questions here. Any others that are different from the ones we heard? Wow. Okay. Yes.
This is more of a comment just to share with some of the things that Uma was mentioning. I represent DIA, which is a Houston-based nonprofit for survivors of domestic violence. And we are a small organization in the community, but we are doing a lot more work than several of the so-called bigger organizations in terms of direct services. And one of the things that we have thought about in the last year and we have embarked on but not fully marketed is online contributions. And I think one of the things that you said is instead of, yes, I think going to individual donors and making an individual pitch for bigger amounts, But what we have found is that there's a lot of sympathy from the second generation young professionals, whether they are college students or, you know, people just embarking on a career, whether it's attorneys or doctors. We get a lot of sympathy from them, and they are more open to talking about domestic violence and, you know, supporting the cause. And I'm thinking, you know, and that's the direction we want to go also this year, is it could be $25 contributions or $50 contributions, not necessarily in the hundreds and thousands, coming up with a sponsorship plan towards a certain cause. Like it could be sponsoring like a rent for a client, or, you know, sponsoring education, getting her a driver's license, or buying groceries for our transitional home. And that is something that we have initiated, but we have not fully marketed it. But I think that could be a useful tool for smaller communities where you're not necessarily going on to thing. And I personally feel that that is something that will probably be successful in the next, you know, few years to come. But it's just the way that how you market it out. And online contributions is the way to go. You know, a lot of people, especially there.
Thanks for sharing that, Courtney, also, because we did want this to be a little bit of a peer exchange. And those are great ideas about what you all are doing to connect your donors. I didn't see your hand up too there. I'm going to pause, though, Vinita as well, just to get these questions answered. Otherwise, we'll all forget them, and then we'll do another round. So just to synthesize, there are a number of questions for the folks representing philanthropy. So let's just start with that, and then I want to go to Sunil and Uma around both major individual donor giving, especially. The questions I heard were, one, are collaborations and partnerships the mode, you know, in terms of what funders are looking for? Number two, if you are sort of a new grantee and you're not getting, you know, in, and because the foundation doesn't know more for now, how do you still present yourself in a viable manner? And then thirdly, if you're not a direct service group and that's not all that you do, how do you present sort of your the way that you work, even if it's a slightly different model? Are funders averse to that? I would think not, but it would be great to hear about that from people. Who wants to start?
I think I'll start with your question about sort of what to do with the Sanofi project, right? And I would say, you know, take that for what it is, which is just, it's just a frame. I would sort of say that what we all need to do in this room is make sure that in your sort of relationships with philanthropy, that you're kind of framing the issue, right? So with that one, and I have a couple of suggestions. One is, I think you have to understand kind of where people are coming from when they say that. They're very concerned about the investments that they've already made. And it's very hard when you've invested in an organization over time to pull back that grant, knowing that that means that somebody might lose their job, that some project that you think is really necessary might not happen. At the same time, where you're coming from, I think you have to help the program officer or the foundation focus on what the immediate need right now is and whether that need is being met. And if it's not being met, how are you going to meet that need? So it's really about kind of moving people to kind of this kind of present moment and what's needed. And I will say, I think that, you know, there are lots of conversations happening in philanthropy right now about exactly this issue, about, you know, how do we safeguard the investments that have been made over time, and yet how can we be flexible so that we respond to kind of this political moment and all that seems possible right at the moment that the resources are disappearing. So, you know, you're not kind of walking in having to start that conversation. That is a pre-existing conversation. And you know, sort of use that however you can. And the last thing I'll say on that is, think about, you know, what's new here. So what I mean by that is maybe the project is new. Maybe the project has never been funded or hasn't received funding from this particular organization. But maybe you are not new to the foundation. And so foundations, you know, oftentimes what they're really funding is a person, is a leader that they have, that they're confident in. I mean, I will tell you, like, nobody funds our proposal just based on the proposal. It's really about who's behind that. And it's a very important thing to understand, and it's something that from doing my first round of grants, I saw that people don't understand that. People think that if you just send an application in, but there's not, you know, some kind of connection that somehow that's sufficient. And it's, the question is, this piece of this like proposal that you sent to me, like, what is your capacity to actually do this? Right? So there has to be a relationship. There has to be some confidence. So if you have a relationship from your prior job with a foundation, but now you're at a new organization, you're not new. You know? And so don't go in there saying, I'm like the, you know, you fund me, I'm a new project. Go in there and say, I'm your old friend. You know, I've delivered in the past. I've you know, executed all these projects, and I'm doing something that needs to happen right now.
Shad, you just got such a direct answer. The piece on collaborations and partnerships, can we talk about that a little bit more than Mo was asking about?
I want to hit on two things. One is the community philanthropy aspect of it, and then the second I want to talk about is around linkages and connections. So the first thing is that next year, I'm going to lobby Salt and Viva to have a panel on community philanthropy, because I think that would actually maybe solve or kind of pose solutions to many of the problems that we're seeing. So the first one is that we can't wait for organized philanthropy to find our communities. We can't, because if we're going to wait, then we're going to be waiting forever. The latest research is that the top 25 foundations in the country have spent 0.3% of dollars, grant-making dollars, on our community in the last 3 years. 0.3%. So we're waiting for them, and that's an April report that I can share with you right now. Oh, great. Oh, fantastic. So 0.3%. So you can wait until the cows come home and be part of the very, very kind of exclusive group of people that get resources from organized philanthropy, or you can start to build a movement of community philanthropy. And when I say community philanthropy, there's different definitions from it, but when I say it, it means giving by the community for the community. There's nothing more powerful than that space for a couple reasons. One is, if you're truly a community-based organization, what does it mean to be community-based? One is, you're serving the community, so you're getting funded by the community. So when my fellow panelists were talking about the power of individual donors, it's another way of selling the fact that you're authentic, accountable CEO. Second is that funders mostly are concerned in this economic environment, in this kind of recession, about sustainability. What better way to tell a funder that you're sustainable by looking at your individual donor base and saying, look, your grant isn't going to make or break us, because we have accumulated a whole group of individual donors that give us basically general office support. But your grant will allow us to get to the next level, to push your grant-making strategies forward.
Yeah.
I think that would be my frame if I were writing a grant. And so the frame is around sustainability. I think that's what we're worried about. Those that read proposals are really worried about, if we give a grant to you, what's going to happen next year? Because the well is really dry right now, and probably going to be dry in the future. So I cannot tell you about the powerful position. And there's some great models. The folks from this coalition have had amazing, amazing models of kind of building philanthropy from the ground up. I know folks from Muslim Advocates are trying, they're experimenting with that. There's different models of trying to experiment with community philanthropy, which includes donor circles, giving circles. And so I just wanted to comment on that piece of it, and then sustainability piece. And then the second piece around linkages and connections. So I have that little bit of, I'm not sure if people will agree with this, but traditionally mainstream philanthropy, organized foundations, and specifically national foundations, have looked to national nonprofits as a panacea. If they just fund one organization, if they just fund that one national civil rights organization, if they just find that one silver bullet, they will be, you know, it'll be social change forever. And I'm not sure if they got the memo yet, because it's not happening. And the thing is, if it worked, I may be behind that strategy, may get behind that strategy, but it doesn't work. And so, truth be told, I don't actually think, so when you're in site visits, people aren't asking you about who do you collaborate with. I think that is not uncommon. But we know that we need to develop relationships and connections with each other, whether a national organization or a local or regional organization, in order to see the change. So regardless if philanthropy cares about your linkages and connections or coalitions, I could care less. But we know it takes all of those kind of threads to be pulled together to create a social movement. So it's almost like, I don't care if, you know, you're being told to collaborate. We know that it takes collaboration and connections to make the work happen.
that's my personal.
Great. I do want to, let me bring in Sunil and Hillary and Uma on the community philanthropy piece, because I wanted to touch on that, and then we'll go back to questions, a round of questions from folks that you on my list. I'm going to come back to you on that too. So Sunil, and let's start with you, Sunil. And there was a question about individual major donors. There were some questions back there about, you know, how to get sort of younger folks engaged in philanthropy. So I'm wondering if the three of you could talk a little bit about the importance of community philanthropy and so maybe some tips that you've seen that have worked, some models for people to use.
Sure. And actually, the tips that I have actually focus on individual major donors, because I've been doing my specialty for years. So, that was a perfect question. I have been successful with individual major donors, and major donors is however you define whatever is major to you. It's totally true. It could be 500, you know. I used to work at a gay and lesbian organization where it was at 1,500. You know, that was the startup point. But however you define it. The most successful key is using the board. You know, I mean, it's pretty much, you know, Deep and I have conversations about this. I'm on the board fundraising committee for itself. So it's about using your board. And I know, you know, and to echo Uma, it's hard, you know, to get a board engaged. I'm working, yeah, because you all know. But the point is that it really does come down to the board. And actually, so we know that there are challenges with the board, so let me tell you what one specific thing that worked for me with working with a board. Actually, I've worked with several boards, so this is not necessarily a South Asian example, but I worked with a board that was really reticent about fundraising. Oh, we don't fundraise. It's not part of our background. We're not comfortable with that. I never was told that I had to fundraise as part of board membership, which I found baffling. But what I did was I identified one person on the board who got fundraising down and wanted to make an example of that person for the rest of the board. So had that person do a major donor event, having him invite his friends, all of whom worked in the financial industry, because he was in the financial industry, and invited the board members to come, coached him through that event, and we had raised around $15,000 from around 10 people at that event, because he was coached from beginning to end. And the rest of the board was shocked. And it actually spurred the rest of the board to say, well, I want to do one too now. And I really want to do an event, and I can do more. Basically, they didn't say it like that, but you know, you have a competitive drive now. And actually, that works actually among television, yeah, especially in a particular industry. So, that's one example of how you could use one person as a key influencer to affect change across a board, because it really does boil down to the board. I don't know 500 individual major donors personally. I wouldn't work in nonprofit. My job is to connect people to back to the organization and actually facilitate. I'm the frontier behind the scenes. That's what the job is, and clear the hands away. The other tip is regarding individual major donors is going to where they are. I think that we get calls a lot from employee resource groups and corporations, you know, Asian American groups. Don't ignore them. And if you haven't reached out to them, reach out to them because they're clamoring for volunteer opportunities. Realize that volunteer opportunities equals, you know, money down the line. So even if there's no opportunity right now, it may seem like a chore to put up with a group of corporate employees who want to paint a room or something like that, it will translate into dollars down the line if you are able to work the connections correctly. Because some of these corporations, large and small, they're going to recover at some point. You might as well get in when you can. So you go to them, and then basically you create the mountain for, you know, the Mohammeds to come to. That's the events, and Uma had mentioned this as well. Key takeaway is like asking your board member to host an event, host and underwrite the event. Don't pay for it. You have to have your board member pay for it. Insist on that. Keep your cost of fundraising low, because you know that the 990s are acquiring. How's the fundraising now? Keep it below 30% ideally. Have your board member host an event, and even if they are not comfortable with fundraising, just have them create the event. Just invite their friends to talk about your organizations. Have that be step one at the very least. One other thing that worked really well for us, and it could probably work all for you as well, for individual major donors as well as for institutional funders, is that we open our doors outside at open houses for you know, individual donors, prospects, you know, foundation contacts. And you know, even if you work for organizations that are basically offices, you know, desks and whatnot, you'll be amazed at the number of people who want to come and learn more about you. So I would open up your spaces, and it's as easy as, you know, getting a Whole Foods, you know, platter and, you know, drink, and that's it. It doesn't even have to be, you know, you don't even have to have alcohol, but really just invite people in.
Can I want to pause really quickly, because I know you talk a lot about major kind of donors and getting major donors involved, and I know you work, Chloe, with a lot of really small emerging groups, and as we heard from some of the groups here, many are even volunteer-based, where they don't have staff. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit, either about in terms of building community support, or even for the volunteer-based groups that are providing services. Whether it's like a toll-free hotline number, for example, but are stuck in this time where they can't get to the funders because of the new grantee situation. What are you seeing, especially, you know, in this local area as an example, and some ideas you might want to share?
Well, again, I think I'm thinking of a couple of small groups I've been working with that have some staff and volunteers and part-time staff. And one group in particular where we just kind of brought key people together and we just brainstormed. So I think another, again, going back to that message of, you know, use what you have and not just your board, but your staff and your volunteers to help think about kind of out-of-the-box ideas. And so we took an afternoon and we just kind of looked at every single activity this organization does and said, where is there an opportunity to raise money from that activity? And this is an organization, the Latino organization, that does a lot of financial literacy and working with people who are unbanked and doing micro enterprise kinds of things. And they run a market. They've trained women that then have, you know, sell food at a market. So they, you know, as we were talking, it sort of came up that this market is every Saturday. We have a little sign there saying we sponsor the market, but that's it. So what the financial literacy promoters, who are members of the community, who have been to this training program, who do the training workshops and get, you know, pay a stipend to do that, said we could be out there, you know, every Saturday just talking to the people who walk by and put out a donations box and just say, hey, this is the organization, this is what we do, we're a part of, you know, behind this. So they've started doing that, and they've kind of organized shifts, and, you know, every you know, one Saturday a month somebody will go for 3 or 4 hours and they'll stand there and they'll just catch people, you know, walking by. So I think it's again, it's really looking, engage everybody in your organization. Everybody can have a role in this. And to really look creatively at what you do. And I, you know, having come from being a co-founder and volunteer executive director of a small community-based arts organization, pass the hat every chance you get, whatever you're doing. So.
Thank you. So let's take a couple of more questions. We've got about 10 minutes left. So talk about
Taha with the Pakistan American Leadership Center. One of the challenges that we face is we're an advocacy organization for the Pakistan American community, and we have several large major individual donors. And what happens is a lot of times we'll work really hard to get a meeting with a very prominent individual, maybe in the administration, for example. And, you know, because, you know, our donors and our board knows that we're going to have this meeting, they, you know, obviously demand to be a part of that meeting. And a lot of times for the professional staff, you know, we're working really hard and refining our message and we know the issues in and out, but the donors are kind of maybe a little bit removed and they're not always on point, they're not always on the message. So how do you kind of stop the donors from kind of interfering with the professionalism of your message and of, you know, the look of your organization? And sometimes even it goes to the message where it's like, you know, we've been working on issues, this is exactly how nuanced we want our position to be, and your donors might have different opinions on your position. And not necessarily, but it's like they might not have that same level of professionalism that you have. So how do you deal with that tension?
I'm Vinita Jafwani, and I'm a longtime volunteer with Manavi. And actually, I think Sunil made this point earlier, but I'd be curious to maybe hear what Dimple and Archana have to say regarding
What organizations need to show funders is they have to demonstrate relevance and effectiveness. And I'd kind of be curious, what does that look like for some organizations? Often, there may not be a built-in evaluation component to a lot of the funding that organizations get. So what is the expectation that we should be feeding back that will demonstrate, effectiveness?
Thank you. Last question.
I just want to say, I'm Riz Marka, chairperson of My Family Services, which is a Michigan-based organization. We are a community-based organization, and our funding, all so far funding has come from community. And all those tricks we just mentioned do work. That's the number two, what we have done, whenever the donors, now they are also looking for effectiveness. So what we found out, that we have made a pie chart that of the total amount, how much goes in administration and how much goes in direct services, and that pie chart has been very, very effective.
Great, thank you for sharing that. So let's start with you, and feel free to answer sort of any amalgam, but I'm going to ask that we end to go down the line. So I'm going to ask you all to keep it probably like 2 minutes or so and use it as your closing as well. So I think there was a question that you might want to
I just wanted to get to a couple of things that we left from the last room. One was around younger folks and getting those engaged. And I wanted to say, in addition to what Neil said and what a lot of people have said, that also to treat them like you would treat any other donor, to take them and give them the special attention that you would give any donor, to say, actually, your donation is really important to us too, and that's really what gets people to give repeatedly anyway. So in terms of the younger donors, like, treat your younger donors like you would treat any donor, and thank them and recognize them equally. And the other thing, Kritika, you talked about how to get funders to understand your framework as different from direct services. And I know that Archanand and Paul talked about this a little bit, but the other thing I would say in addition to that is to really be straightforward and ask what the priority is of that funder, because there are funders that might give to prevention and community-based approaches as opposed to direct services, and those are the people you want to go after, because if people are really interested in giving just to direct services, you trying to change their mind on that is going to take more energy than it might be worth, because you might not, and that's fair for them and that's fair for you. For you to actually go after people whose framework is yours, or perspective is yours.
Thank you.
And then you said something about donors and professionalism, and I think that there's something about just matching your needs with what is out there. So actually finding what is relevant to that donor, what they can get in on, that's not necessarily meeting with this famous person, So finding opportunities that match the needs, and we can talk more about that, and I'm sure other people have ideas, but basically you don't bring them to that meeting, You don't, because you don't want to screw it up for your organization, and that's your priority. But you find another opportunity that actually works for them, that meets their need to get in on the action, And there are different ideas for that. But that's kind of what I want to say. The final thing I want to say, I know I'm out, but is to not forget who you are and who your mission is. I really want to come back to that all the time. So, for example, at CHIA, we're a domestic violence organization, and the reality of domestic violence is that we don't know who abusers are and who they aren't. So, so to actually think that relates to our fundraising strategies too, we actually are really careful about the donor list that we publish, about the pictures that we put in our brochures and things like that, because it's a real issue, and we don't want to compromise the integrity of who we are and what our mission is and who women are out there or surviving, people that are surviving that might see their abuser's picture or their abuser's name. So just to also remember that in your fundraising, even though we're all in crisis mode and panicked, don't forget who you are. That's my
Thank you for giving us that closing to each of you to think about that. So to answer to any of the questions that you've heard in the second round, or to kind of give us a little bit of a closing.
I guess just a little bit more of a closing. I think about this, as we kind of the theme in the very beginning, that there is a silver lining to this, and there is an opportunity, and and so many small organizations, for so many smaller organizations, this is reality. So it's, a lot of the groups I work with, it's kind of like, okay, everybody else, welcome to our world, because this is what we've been dealing with for a long time, having to juggle and be creative. And I think what I would urge you to also think about is, how do you use this as an opportunity to build capacity? within your organization, so that as you're looking at both kind of long-term strategy and building relationships, as well as sort of short-term, you know, low-hanging fruit, like let's at our market on Saturdays, we can start asking for donations. How do you use those opportunities to train more people, to get more people involved, to make the to build leadership, broader leadership in your organization, putting new systems in place? Again, that all takes time, but how do you kind of use this to really build capacity for the long term?
I'm thinking for saying what I was going to say. So as my closing, so I don't think I mentioned this, but this is my real deal, like 1 minute. We know that there's increased scrutiny for Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, and South Asian nonprofits. I don't think that's been said, but that is what I see, and that's what I have seen, and that's what I'm sad to say that I will continue to see that. And so because there is increased scrutiny, especially if you're doing advocacy work around post-9/11 issues and policies, that you need to, one, like we said, continue to develop those relationships with your advocates on the ground, grass tops, in philanthropy. Two, couple that with community philanthropy, and I think you're going to be good. And then finally, what Hillary said, I cannot tell you that because of so much scrutiny, you got to make sure that your organizational development is on par. And whether that's your tobacco organization, which is around your budget, making sure that makes sense and adds up to zero, you're not in the black, you're not in the red, you're just even. Or your linkages and connections are great, or your activities are properly done because you've done a needs assessment. And so really use this time as an opportunity, because the recession isn't here forever. So this is an opportunity to kind of look within and look for opportunities outside.
Thanks.
To answer the question posed in the back row about effectiveness and demonstrating that, I think that the pie chart that this gentleman mentioned is one good way. The other good way is basically having a business or strategic plan for the fact that you're starting that. And the fact that you have long-term vision, that would be, I would say, the number one way. I'm going to leave you with, that you won't be within time, 6 extremely specific tips, because I was thinking, you know, what money for, right? And I was thinking, these are things you could do on Monday, right now. So, one is to sign up for a subscription to Hopful of Philanthropy if you haven't already. And if you already have all these things, then you're ahead of the game. The Chicago Philanthropy is awesome. They list, obviously, funder opportunities, look at the list of new grants that foundations have been giving, see who is giving to like organizations. And if it's too expensive, ask a colleague who works at an organization that does have the Chicago Philanthropy, because they have those reply cards, so you should usually have discounts. Two, sign up for free subscriptions to Agenda Magazine and BizBash, especially if you're looking into special events. For the New York area, it's free because they want to build up their subscriber base. And if you don't live in the area of this of these magazines, getting their electronic newsletters at least are so amazing for me, because all the fabulous ideas for events, and the fact that they're having a major emphasis on keeping events at low cost too. Three, schedule a call with your board member or talk to your board member on Monday about hosting that fundraising event. I mentioned that before. So do that on Monday. Four, use the Foundation Center directory. I'm sure many of you know it. If you don't, I definitely look it up. The Foundation Center is a fantastic resource. They have a location in New York and in several cities around the country, but they're also available at public libraries across the country. And there are free databases for looking at funder opportunities. Definitely use them. And it's free if you go to the public library or go to the Foundation Center. Five, look into getting an AmeriCorps member, which is basically the domestic version of Peace Corps. Sometimes we laid out a whole bunch of ideas that you're thinking, oh my God, I don't have the time to do this. But you could look into freer help, because I think that there's a match. But I don't think the match is even that much. An AmeriCorps member is having one dedicated person. That's how you could build capacity. And six, get onto government agency listservs. So, for instance, in New York, the Department of Youth and Community Development, DYCD, even if you don't get government funding, and even if you don't think that you will get it, get yourself on those listservs, because they actually list private funder resources, too, because they want to help. they're potential grantees. So I'll leave you with that.
Thank you. That's very, very
good. That's great.
Yeah. Simple, you have the last word here.
So quickly, the question about relevance and effectiveness, I think there's no general answer that I can give that except to say that it's something that you should talk to whoever funds you about early on in the process. Because at some point you will be evaluated, even if it's just a renewal. So make sure that you have sort of shared understanding about how your work is going to be evaluated, and take that on and come up with your own criteria for what evaluation should look like. You're probably the best authority on how your work is effective or how it should be measured. And then sort of as a closing, I shared this article called Four Futures, which the program officer that I work with, we all sort of had a discussion about this recently, and I wanted to just sort of, as my closing thought, read a couple of lines from it. This basically sets out kind of the crisis that's happening with nonprofits and sort of different approaches that people can take. And I really like sort of these lines of this paragraph called transformation. Nonprofits can use the faltering economy and the impact on the sector as an opportunity to reinvent themselves. But this approach requires examining all possible options quickly and creatively. Are there ways to redesign organizations to achieve greater synergy between community players? Are there ways to involve communities in rethinking and re-energizing our work? A transformation-oriented approach requires deliberate and collective action by the sector stakeholders. Communities, philanthropists, government, intermediaries, constituents, nonprofit associations, and boards. All of this is new. So I wanted to sort of leave us with this idea that I know it's a difficult time, but that there are always possibilities for transformation.
And that we're all in it together.
Yeah.
Well, please join me in thanking our panelists.